The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Almost 2 weeks into 2017, there have been 1,322 gun-related incidents in the United States and 342 deaths. That's according to the Gun Violence Archive. For most people who sustain traumatic injuries from bullets or from car crashes, death occurs within an hour. A trial at one of the country's leading trauma centers aims to keep victims alive longer using profound hypothermia, basically freezing circulation of critically wounded victims when every second counts. The experiment at Baltimore's Shock Trauma Center has been called blasphemy by some in the medical field and raises questions of consent, ethics, and racism in a country with a sordid history of medical experiments on African Americans. Nicola Twilley is co-host of the Gastropod podcast, and she's a contributing writer for The New Yorker, where she reported on this story. And Nicola, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So this process, it's called Emergency Preservation and Resuscitation, or EPR. How does it work?
When someone comes into the emergency room with a gunshot wound and their heart stops, and the medics open the chest at that point, typically they have this sort of device that it looks like a medieval torture instrument, and they spread the ribs and get in there to the heart. Normally, at that point, they would start massaging the heart to try and get it going again and keep the person alive. Instead, with EPR, emergency preservation and resuscitation, what they're going to do is put in a cannula and start pumping that person full of ice-cold saline solution. And in 20 minutes, they're aiming to get their body temperature down to 50 degrees, which when you think about healthy temperatures, sort of between 97 and 99 degrees Fahrenheit, that's really cold. 50 degrees is profound hypothermia. And they're pumping all the blood out of the body, so there will be no blood left in this person, just ice-cold saline.
Mm. So they will have no blood, no pulse, and no brain activity. What is the risk of brain damage from a procedure like this?
That's actually sort of the point of the procedure, is to avoid brain damage. So the idea is, you know, if your brain stops receiving enough oxygen in blood, you have about 5 minutes before it starts to be damaged and starts to die, basically. And so that's really the problem with gunshot victims, is they're losing blood so fast that often the brain damage will set in before surgeons can sew them up and deal with the other holes that are letting all the blood out. So EPR, the idea is, it sort of works like a fridge. It slows things down. When things are in the cold, metabolism is slower, and the idea is your brain will just need less oxygen at this very, very cold temperature. And so it won't be sort of gasping for oxygen and dying off because it doesn't have enough oxygen. The cold will actually be preserving it so that the surgeons can find out where the bullet holes are, stitch them up, and then gradually reheat you and, you know, start circulating blood again, bring you up to temperature. And the idea is your brain will be intact.
Well, this procedure, the idea of cooling patients until you can treat them, has been, and you point out in the article, been called blasphemy by some in the medical field. So what is the opposition?
Well, so surgeons, as a general rule, think of hypothermia in their, you know, in their trauma patients as a really, really bad thing. It's actually part of the triad of death, which sounds super ominous, but there are three sort of things that happen to a trauma patient. They get cold, the pH level in their blood plasma drops, and then their blood stops coagulating, stops kind of forming clots. And all of those three sort of feed into each other, and it's a sort of a death spiral for trauma patients. So it's dogma on the trauma ward that if a patient starts getting cold, they're going to die. and that you should do everything you can to keep them warm. So for surgeons, this is sort of a counterintuitive idea in a lot of ways.
So you spoke to and followed around, it looks like, the director of the EPR trial, Sam Tischerman. He's a professor of surgery at the University of Maryland, which is the teaching hospital where the shock trauma unit is centered. What gave him this idea, and is it working?
So, I mean, Sam Tischerman is a guy who has spent his entire career working on this idea, and it really stems from a frustration that he had as a very junior doctor in his early days, seeing young, perfectly healthy men come in with gunshot wounds that were perfectly fixable if only you had more time. And he's just been obsessed with this idea of sort of buying them time ever since. This trial has taken something like 30 years to get going. And so in terms of doing the research around it and developing the techniques and then getting the approvals and the funding and so on like that. So he's been working on it for a long time. Doctors have been experimenting with cooling for a while. There was a Canadian surgeon, Wilfred Bigelow, who discovered in the 50s that if you anesthetized dogs and then lowered their temperature, they needed less oxygen to survive. For every degree that you sort of dropped their temperature, they needed a certain percentage less oxygen. And early heart surgeons used that information to do the first open heart surgery. They just kind of put the little girl in refrigerated blankets and just bought a little extra time to stop her heart and fix it.
And how about the trials now to date? Has Sam and his team been able to save patients before bleeding out?
I know, isn't that the question? So I'm dying to know that too. The trial finally got started this fall, at October, November time. For the first 10 patients that they try it on, they're not going to release results until they have done those 10 patients, until the trial is complete. Probably it has. Probably they've seen some candidates in Baltimore and they have tried it. Has it worked? I don't know, and they won't say.
I'm speaking with Nicola Twilley. She's co-host of the podcast Gastropod. She's also a contributing writer for The New Yorker, where she wrote about trials at a Baltimore trauma center experimenting with using hypothermia to save gunshot victims. Well, in addition to the skepticism in the medical community, there is this ethical question here of consent. Patients will be incapable of giving consent if they're clinically dead. So what is the protocol in cases like this?
This is a known problem with trauma research in general. The FDA has a way of handling this because people who have been severely injured are very rarely in a position to give their consent, and their family are probably not standing there ready to give it either. And you don't have time to find the family frequently. So the FDA sort of allows a sort of specific exception for what's called waived consent trials, where consent is not possible. And what you typically have to do to be allowed to do one of these waived consent trials is you have to do a community consultation process. So you have to show the FDA and your hospital review board and all of these sorts of governing bodies that try to make sure that clinical trials are ethical. You have to show them that you have made an effort to let as many of the people who might be affected by this trial know about it, share their concerns, have a way to opt out. So in Baltimore, you could opt out of this trial. You still can, as it happens. All you have to do is sort of say, I want to opt out on the website or give a call, and they will send you a little rubber bracelet. It's a red rubber bracelet, like sort of like those Lance Armstrong, Livestrong ones. And you wear it, and it says no to EPR. And that way, if you are shot and you are brought into shock trauma, they will know that you have said no. Of course, the community consultation process, and I sat in on this. I went to, you know, a sort of setting up shop at a mall and handing out leaflets and things like that. It's limited in who it can reach. I mean, people are busy. Are they going to stop and listen to someone trying to explain to them this complex medical procedure that they don't think will ever apply to them? Probably not. So it's not a perfect solution. It's a long way from what you would call informed consent, but that's that's the sort of compromise that the FDA recommends.
And this, of course, is a city where 90% of the victims of gunshot wounds are black men under 30, and a country where black people with gunshot injuries are more than twice as likely to die as whites. I found all of this in your article. But also the backdrop of American history and mistrust of the medical community. If you could run us through some of the points of that history that has made African Americans so mistrustful of medical experimentation.
Right. And this is something that I think if you're not African American, you might not know. But it's a shocking history of medical experimentation and mistreatment applied by the medical establishment to black people. So, I mean, what the most sort of notorious example of African Americans essentially being used as guinea pigs is the Tuskegee syphilis trial, where African American men were, the treatment that would have saved their lives was withheld purely so researchers could see the progression of the disease. I mean, that's just one of the most unethical things you can possibly imagine, and yet went on relatively recently. Even among, you know, surgeons today, with the best will in the world, there is good, solid evidence that African Americans receive, for example, less pain medication. People trace this back to the idea that under slavery, the myth was, oh, African Americans feel less pain, and that's why it's okay to beat them or whip them occasionally, or work them harder than you would a white. And so these pervasive myths have ended up in situations where, with the best will in the world, and, you know, I think a lot of surgeons would say that they're not racist, and yet they're still prescribing less medication for pain for African Americans. So there's this very troubled history, and I think among the African American community, the result is a huge mistrust of the medical establishment, which then cuts two ways, because often African Americans don't want to sign up for clinical trials, and so medication isn't optimized for them. So it's a really pernicious and pervasive situation.
And this kind of complexity, too, that medical experimentation is necessary. It's given us so much, you know, through the years, could end up saving more lives. And in cases of gunshot wounds, let's look at, you know, Baltimore or Chicago, black lives. So how are the various sides approaching resolving this?
I mean, yeah, it's really, really difficult, because among the African-American folks that I spoke to in Baltimore, so many had lost sons and nephews to gun violence. Families would lose routinely two or three of a generation of black men. And there was a strong feeling that if these guys could have a second chance, I mean, and for many of them, they've never had a second chance at anything in life. You could argue they haven't really had a first chance. That giving them this second chance would be something that the people were strongly in favor of. And yet at the same time, you know, there we were, sat in the Mondawmin Mall, which is, you know, was the site of looting and riots after the Freddie Gray murder, essentially. And there's an African-American man coming up to the table and saying, you all are using us as guinea pigs. You don't even need to say anything. I know what's going on. And so there's very, very mixed responses. What the hospital has done is it has jumped through a lot of hoops to try to get out there and do these community consultations, be part of kind of gun violence conversations with folks. It says, and I found this to be true, that it does have a good relationship with the community. It's sort of right on the edge of West Baltimore there. So it is the community it serves, and it is sort of tied to that community. It's difficult. The surgeons themselves are very sensitive to this point. They want to do everything they can. They want to have all the tools they can have to save lives. But at the same time, there's no real way to say that this is informed consent, and so there's always an edge. One thing I think that is really interesting is a medical ethicist called Harriet Washington was talking to me. She's written a lot about experimentation on African Americans, and she said there's this thing called the therapeutic illusion, where surgeons are so sure and people are so sure that a radical new treatment, it could work, that they don't even see it as an experiment. They see it as a treatment. And I found, even while reporting this story, that I was falling into that hole. I was like, why wouldn't you do this? You have such poor chances otherwise. I mean, by the time you get to the stage where they will be doing EPR, you have like a 1 in 20 chance of making it anyway. You're going to die, pretty much. And so why wouldn't you want to try this? And Harriet pointed out, you know, that's the therapeutic illusion. You think this is going to be more effective than the existing standard of care because you have this sense of progress and medicine always moving forward, but actually it might not work. And then is it ethical? So I think there's just a lot of difficult questions about how we think about who to try these kinds of trauma surgeries on, because you can never get consent in the moment. So is it ethical to do them?
Nicola Twilley, she's co-host of the podcast Gastropod and a contributing writer for The New Yorker. Thank you so much for telling us about your reporting on this. That's an absolutely fascinating story.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And you'll find a link to read her New Yorker piece, Can Hypothermia Save Gunshot Victims?, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Weather events and disasters can be ferocious. Tornadoes, earthquakes, tsunamis. These sudden forces strike quickly and leave destruction in their wake. In December of 1952, London, England was struck by a much more quiet calamity, a heavy blanket of smog so thick that thousands died. In a city known for pea soupers, the event came to be known as the Great Smog and was recently remembered on the Netflix series The Crown.
Good morning. The time is 8 o'clock on the 8th of December, and here is the news. The choking, eye-watering fog, which has already caused 2 days of chaos across the capital, has worsened overnight. The great coal-burning electricity stations in Battersea and Fulham have attempted to reduce emissions of poisonous sulfur dioxide from their chimneys, but we've been told that it is unlikely they'll be able to make any significant change to the air quality. The government is expected to make a statement later today.
Dr. Christine Corton is author of London Fog, the biography, and joins us now to talk about the Great Smog. Christine, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for inviting me.
So the fog is so dense, locals call them pea soupers. How thick does it get?
Well, it got so thick that you could literally not see your hand in front of your face. You certainly couldn't see your feet when you were standing up. I mean, during the 19th century, when many of these fogs took place, people would literally just walk into the Thames because they couldn't actually see the drop into the Thames. So they would drown. So it was pretty blinding.
Set the scene for us. What are the conditions that led to this great smog in 1952, and why so especially dangerous?
Well, of course, it's to do with coal burning. I mean, as the Industrial Revolution took off, more coal was burnt in both industry and in the domestic homes. And this with a natural fog problem that London has. It's in a basin. It's surrounded, it had a river running through it. It's surrounded by fairly moist marshlands, and certainly was during the 19th century. It has a natural fog problem. But then when you mix it with this rather lethal cocktail of coal smoke coming from chimneys, especially coal smoke that hadn't quite been combusted properly. So it was filled with large particulates that would get into the air, mix with the cold, foggy air. It would get compressed down into these very narrow streets of London and become lethal.
You mentioned people walking into the Thames. How did people die in this fog?
Well, as I say, I mean, traffic accidents. I mean, you could be run over by a horse and carriage because you literally could not see it coming. And of course, the fog would muffle sound, so you couldn't even hear a horse and carriage coming. In the 20th century, when cars became more prevalent, you were very likely to be run over by a car. You literally could not see the car coming. You couldn't hear it coming. And of course, cars couldn't see their way on the road. So they might end up on a pavement, going into a front garden. There were many, many accidents, as well as, of course, breathing it in. And if you had vulnerable lung diseases, asthma, emphysema, if you were very young or very elderly, the fog could literally kill you within a couple of days.
What about the infrastructure of London? How did it affect how the city ran, other than, you know, people getting hurt?
Well, traffic couldn't actually run properly. It stopped in the later 20th century. It stopped all aircraft travel. Certainly the 1952 fog literally closed London Airport, as it was called then. Cars were fairly useless. Buses would try to continue a normal service but couldn't, and would literally have to limp back to the bus station, not to be used again until the fog cleared up. So people couldn't get into work, and if people had to get into work, many of them would have to actually walk. There is, in fact, in the 1952 smog, stories of school children, and I find this amazing, school children literally being sent out in the fog to go to school. Parents would just wrap a scarf around their nose and a mouth. They'd go to school, and it would thicken up so much that they would have to then spend the night at school.
And because of the geography, the landscape of London, the fog was worse in the east. Why does that matter?
Well, it was worse in the east kind of during the 19th century. I think during the 20th century, it got increasingly worse over the whole of London, and it became a whole London problem. The fact is that the east end of London became the poorer part of London, partly because of wind direction. So all the smoke from the West End would travel to the east and hang over the east. And also the East End of London had a lot of industry, a lot of smoky industry, which had been banned from the West End of London. In the 18th century, when these big estates were starting to be built, like the Grosvenor Estates, etc., many of the developers would actually forbid smoky industries to site themselves in the West End. So this meant that there was a natural progression of these very smoky industries moving to the East End of London. So that's really why the East End of London becomes a much poorer part of London.
There are stories about upticks in crime. There are stories about people having to walk to the hospital because their ambulances couldn't run. Tell us some of those other stories that you found about the Great Smog. And where did you find them? Newspapers?
Well, newspapers, all kinds of sources, journals, in literature. Lots of authors, of course, write about smog in their works of fiction. And, of course, artists were painting these foggy outbreaks. But other stories, well, I think we should think about the animal life. In 1873, there was a major fog outbreak. It lasted 5 days. And Smithfield Cattle Market happened to be operating at the same time, Smithfield Cattle Show. And so there were all these highly prized cattle who literally could not breathe. They were so highly bred that they couldn't actually breathe the air around them because it was so polluted. And over 90 of them either died, suffocated, or had to be put down because they were panting so piteously. Ironically, the cheaper cattle that was also on show, because they weren't so well bred, could cope with it much more. And also there was a rumour that because their bedding wasn't changed nearly as frequently, that the urine in the bedding would actually disinfect the air around them. And this actually happened in the 1952 smog as well, to a lesser extent, but the Smithfield Cattle Show got held in December, virtually at the same time, and again it was affected. Birds could not actually find a place to land, so they would fly around for hours until they literally fell exhausted in front of a car. In fact, there's a picture in my book of a swan that has done that. It's tried to find a place to land, couldn't, and then just fallen out of the sky. Plant life also suffered. So if you have a major smog, lots of the kind of more exotic plants, their leaves would fall off, the flowers would drop off, they would die. It's one of the reasons why the plane tree is so popular in London, because it was resistant to smoke. And they found this out in the 18th century, so they put lots of plane trees all over London. It's resistant because its bark peels off regularly, so the smoke could not go through to the actual root of the tree. And the leaves are very glossy, so if the smog fell on the leaf, it would actually be rained off and couldn't burn through the leaf.
My guest is Christine Corton. She's author of London Fog, the biography, and she's telling us about the Great Smog of 1952. It was in December in London. It was recently depicted in the Netflix television series The Crown. Now, Christine, I know you haven't seen The Crown, but in the series, the British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who was played by John Lithgow, isn't particularly concerned, even seems a little dismissive of the smog. And another politician who had a little warning about it was using it for political advantage. Was that true?
Well, it's not true of the specific people. I mean, Churchill, I think they're using Churchill because that's the figure most people would know. In fact, Harold Macmillan was the housing minister at the time and the main minister in charge of infrastructure around the 1952 smog. He was very cynical. He felt that people should just cope with it. He actually said anyone would think, when he got a lot of criticism, anyone would think that I'd created the fog. You know, it was here before I was around. And he also, he did not want to deal with it because in order to use more smokeless fuel, you have to have high quality coal because you have to produce more smokeless fuel for people to use. And we were actually exporting a lot of our high quality coal to Europe. And so he didn't want to lose that money coming in. So I think it's slightly unfair on Churchill, actually. I think he's being used to view this whole government cynicism about this 1952 smog. I think many politicians during the 19th century and 20th century tried to introduce legislation, and every time it got passed through Parliament, it was weakened by industrial interests and then by an unwillingness of the government to interfere in the householders' right to burn in their hearth what they wanted to burn. So there was a series of attempts to introduce a Clean Air Act, which of course culminated in the 1956 Clean Air Act, which finally became law.
So the severity of this finally convinced them to do something about reform.
Well, I don't think, I mean, of course it was severe. It was one of the severest episodes. But I think it was more to do with the fact that it was post-Second World War. And I think people had had enough. They said, we haven't fought a war in order to have a capital city that is shrouded in darkness for many months of the year. We want a cleaner city. And I think it was actually the momentum of newspaper articles condemning the air, condemning the government. There were banners across newspapers saying, you are poisoning us, what are you going to do about it? As well as public disapproval of government apathy.
Well, the Great Smog aside, you also write about how London's famous fog, it really is part of the city's character. It's been depicted in paintings and novels. Do you find there some beauty in the fog?
Well, certainly artists like Monet and Whistler find a lot of beauty in it. You have to remember it wasn't just purely black. Colours could be seen in it, green, yellow, purple, certainly the colours that Monet picks out. I mean, he did a series, painted over 100 paintings of London fog, of which about 35, 36 around. People actually saw it in a much less negative light than we perhaps would view it. They saw it as a symbol of success. If you've got foggy, smoky London, you've actually got successful industries pumping out smoke, but also providing employment. It also means you can afford coal on your fire, which actually through much of the 19th, early 20th century, that was your only means of heating your house or cooking your food, etc. People may jokes about it. They accepted it. And I think, you know, there was, even in 1952, there was a bit of a blitz spirit. We must carry on. But I think it had reached a point where people just said, no, we've got to now clean up our air?
Well, now coal burning is one of the big contributors to air pollution in China. And reportedly, Beijing is even launching a new smog police, which will crack down on big polluters. Has Beijing inherited London's smog problem?
Well, I think both China and India, actually, which is another country that suffers from very bad air pollution, they're going through their own industrial development, and just as we did in the 19th and 20th century. I wouldn't criticise them for it. I think they're trying their very best to clean up the air. It's a difficult problem because, of course, economically, it's not something that you can clear up within a week or a year. You have to build new factories. You have to encourage people to use perhaps more expensive forms of energy. Coal is cheap. Is very cheap in China, which is why it's used. Gas and electricity are much more expensive. So governments have to deal with it. But I wouldn't criticise China. We polluted the air in the 19th and 20th century. They now have to find their own solutions.
Dr. Christine Corton, author of London Fog, the biography. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
You can read more about her book and about the Great Smog and find some photographs at wordofmouthradio.org. And we've got a quick update on that story. London's famous or infamous pea supers may be a thing of the past, but that doesn't mean the pollution is gone. Not long after we recorded our conversation with Christine Corton, we read that parts of London have exceeded the city's smog limit for 2017. And that happened in just the first 5 days of this year. The source of the smog is not exactly the same as it was back in those heavy coal-burning days. The problem today is nitrogen dioxide levels, which come mainly from diesel vehicles. Levels are measured hourly and are allowed to exceed 200 micrograms per cubic meter only 18 times a year. That is the goal anyway. Sounds like there's still a long way to go.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The holidays are behind us, which in New England means we're staring down the barrel of several uninterrupted cold, dark, and snowy months. Perfect weather for curling up at home with a good book, television show, or video game.
Do you read me, technician?
I hear you, control.
Visuals on the site?
Yep, looks good.
That's just a clip from a trailer from Tacoma, which is one of the games that video game fans are looking forward to, especially the expert that we're chatting with to learn about what's on the horizon for 2017's most anticipated video games. Chris Sullentrop is contributing video game critic for the New York Times. He's also host of the podcast Shall We Play a Game? And Chris, shall we?
Yes, we shall.
Well, the item at the top of your list is not a game, but a console. Now, news of this, the Nintendo Switch was announced in the fall, but out in 2017. What is it going to be?
Yes. What we know about the Nintendo Switch is a 3-minute YouTube video that Nintendo released, but they will announce it in January in New York, or officially unveil it and let us actually get our hands on it. And then it'll scheduled for release in March. And it is designed to be a console that is both a handheld portable device of the kind that Nintendo has been very successful at making since the Game Boy up through the current generation of consoles that are called the DS, and that you can also hook up to your TV, and that the same game that plays on your television will also play in your hands. And it has other interesting aspects like these controllers that you can slide off the sides and then play with each other, but nobody's seen it. But it's interesting because, of course, Nintendo for 30 years has been inventing and reinventing video games from the original Nintendo Entertainment System to the Wii. And its most recent console, the Wii U, was kind of a dud. They tried to introduce tablet gaming into console video game. It had this big screen that was also a controller. It has some really excellent games for it, but it didn't sell. And so there's a lot of expectations but also burden on the company. But they've really preferred to make their own hardware and tightly bind their games to the hardware they make. And so there's going to be a new Xbox in 2017 as well, but the Nintendo Switch, I think, is the most interesting and risky bet of the two consoles that'll be coming out.
So that's some big news in the console business, but one of the games you are excited about is called Tacoma. We heard just a smidgen from the top. It's a new game from the independent video game studio Fulbright, which is described by them by a story exploration video game. So what does that mean?
Yes, Fulbright is a small studio based in Portland, Oregon, co-founded by a guy named Steve Gaynor, who worked on notable big-budget video games like Bioshock Infinite, among others, and set out with some of his peers to start an independent studio. And they made a game called Gone Home. Gone Home, which is a wonderful video game, but it is controversial among some video game players because it doesn't have a lot of quote-unquote traditional gameplay.
Hmm.
There's nothing to collect. There's no, you know, fighting or shooting or jumping. It's a story of, you sort of uncover the story of two girls as you explore an empty house in the Pacific Northwest. Tacoma, perhaps more traditionally for video games, will be set in the future on a space station, but it's still going to have that sort of archaeological exploration of story. It'll have the first-person perspective that gamers are familiar with from shooters and other games. But this is a studio that's heavily influenced by interactive theater, by the British theater company Punch Drunk, which makes the play Sleep No More. If anyone's seen that, it's in New York. It's a, you know, huge warehouse, and you sort of follow the actors through a space, but you can stop and just, as you can in a video game, you can just stop and explore a desk if you want to instead of following the story. And this, what Tacoma is going to introduce, according to Steve and his colleagues, are these sort of holographic scenes in which you play them and the characters spin off into different directions, and you sort of have, much like you would in Sleep No More, have to decide who to follow.
Well, another game that you are looking forward to, this one's coming out for PlayStation 4, but also focuses on a kind of mysterious narrative. The name is What Remains of Edith Finch. Let's hear just a clip from that.
There are a lot of stories people tell about the Finch family. Most of them end strangely. Some of them don't even seem possible. And they can't all be true, obviously.
Tell us about this game, Chris.
Yeah, What Remains of Edith Finch is the story of a family, the Finches, all of whom have died in mysterious ways, and you play as different members of this family over different time in this creepy old house. And the segment I played, you were a young girl who then goes through a series of very evocative dream sequences. I was an owl and then a shark or some other kind of water creature. And it's beautiful and it's strange, and it's expected to be the first title from Annapurna Interactive, which is a new branch of Annapurna Pictures, the movie studio that released movies like Her and Zero Dark Thirty, and many sort of prestige movie studios. And there hasn't been that kind of label in video games. There's a small one in called Devolver Digital that does indie games, but there hasn't been a video game label that really just exclusively develops and publishes independent sort of prestige video game titles. Annapurna Interactive is trying to come in and sort of fill a void in the market for helping these indie games, which have become more and more popular. Many of them sell millions of copies, or at least a million copies, which, you know, for a record, for a, you know, like a music record, would be unbelievable. But because big video game studios can put out games that sell 30 and 40 and 50 million copies, I think they don't get as excited about a million, unfortunately.
Wow, that's just, the scale is unbelievable. We're getting a little bit of a preview of some most anticipated video games from Chris Sullentrop, who writes about video games for the New York Times, among others. He's also host of the podcast, Shall We Play a Game? You mentioned games and independent game designers working with movie studios. These games are just beautiful, and I urge listeners to go to our website, wordofmouthradio.org, where you can look at some of the trailers for these games and see what they're like. Deeply visual. But I'm interested in that, in the Edith Finch game, a female protagonist, so to speak. Are there more games that seem to be coming out with female protagonists?
There are more. It's a hotly contested and sometimes disputatious conversation among developers, designers, and players about representation in video games. But of course, there have always been female protagonists. Certainly Lara Croft from Tomb Raider is one of the most famous video game characters ever. But the default has been men for a very long time. And but there are certainly more. And there are lots of women players, and so some designers and developers are starting to respond to that audience. But also, you know, games allow men to play as women and to sort of find different perspectives. Some people really want to play as themselves. This is an interesting split among video game players. There's a certain kind of game, of which neither of these that we've talked about are, that give you a character creation screen at the start, and you can sort of create your own face, pick your sex, pick your race. In a fantasy game, maybe pick your species. Some players want to create sort of an idealized version of themselves, right? Like the best possible or slightly better version of who you are,
mm-hmm.
Stronger, prettier.
More muscular.
Thinner. And some players want to play as someone totally different than them.
So there are, of course, a variety of games. There's another one you're looking forward to, Red Dead Redemption 2. That sounds like a more traditional video game. This is developed by the creators of Grand Theft Auto, and it's a multiplayer online game. Why are you looking forward to this one?
Yeah, I mean, speaking of representation issues, there was some grumbling on Twitter that the trailer for this game showed seven men.
It looks like a Western, a traditional Western.
Yeah, the trailer looks very much like the photo for The Magnificent Seven or something like that. Red Dead Redemption, the original game, is, in my opinion, one of the very best video games ever made. It's made by Rockstar Studios, which is the studio behind Grand Theft Auto, among other games. And it is a big open-world Western that is heavily influenced by the classic Western films of Sergio Leone and people like that. And you play as a guy named John Marston who, you know, I don't know about the sequel because they've told us next to nothing about it, but the first one is set during almost the decline of the West. The trains are coming, mechanical things are coming, and John Marston is, finding his way through in that world, and it's totally beautiful in the way that Rockstar games, all of them are. It's violent and immersive, but it's also well written and funny and cinematic. It's expected to come out in the fall. I would be very surprised if this is not the best-selling game of 2017.
Well, one that's also eagerly anticipated, Star Trek Bridge Crew. This is not just a multiplayer experience, but actually one of those virtual reality experiences. So tell us about this game and what you're expecting here.
Yeah, so virtual reality, you know, came to consumers for the first time last year in 2016. We had the release of the Oculus Rift. We had the release of the HTC Vive, a competitor of the Rift. Sony released PlayStation VR. I own all of them because I'm a freak. but they're extremely interesting. You feel like you've teleported and transported to another world. It's definitely early technology. It's a little finicky. But one of the things about this feeling of isolation, because you've put on this headset, you've closed yourself off entirely from the world around you, you feel like you're in another world. Once I reached down to pick something up in the game world, and my hand hit my couch, and I was like, wait, where am I? What's going on? But so because of that, you sometimes feel a little lonely. You feel maybe like the guy in the famous Twilight Zone episode who's super happy because the apocalypse has come and he can read all his books, but then his glasses broke. And sometimes you have that feeling in VR. And so Star Trek Bridge Crew is a multiplayer game. It's a social game in which everyone gets to play one of the characters in Star Trek as you would on the Enterprise, and you work together to get through some sort of, you know, crisis for the Enterprise. And there's something really magical in virtual reality about looking at another virtual character and seeing them in your space and feeling like you're present together. That's something that games have brought us for a very long time, but there's something different about being in a game, and I like these games, but being in a game in which you run around and shoot each other, you don't feel quite as present socially as you do in a game like Bridge Crew.
Chris, thank you for the preview.
Oh, you're welcome. It was fun.
Chris Sullentrup, he's contributing video game critic for the New York Times. He's also host of the podcast Shall We Play a Game? You'll find a link to his list of 2017 video game recommendations, along with trailers for those games, really worth looking at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for spending some of your holiday weekend with us. Music in this episode came from Poddington Bear, Blue Dot Sessions, and David Seste. There's loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're also on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back Monday at 2 on NHPR.